Hello and welcome to the Manage Self, Lead Others podcast, mainly for experienced and aspiring people managers. I'm your host, Nina Sunday. This is the show to help you explore ways to become the best version of yourself at work as a manager. Each episode, you'll hear from some of the brightest business minds on the planet who share your passion to elevate and transform team culture. They share insights in self-leadership and leading others. Together, we can make workplace culture better. Are you ready? Because it's time to manage self, lead others. My guest today is futurist Rod Collins, host of the podcast Thinking Differently on C-Suite Radio Network, exploring how technological innovations transform the rules for how businesses succeed. Rod's books include Wiki Management, highlighting tools and practices of a revolutionary new management model, and Leadership in a Wiki World, which illustrates how leaders can leverage the power of collective intelligence to sustain extraordinary performance in rapidly changing markets. Rod presents on how emerging technologies such as blockchain, the Internet of Things, and artificial intelligence will dramatically transform business, products, and operating models. I'm looking to discuss today all this plus Rod's views on leading leaders. Let's listen in on my conversation with Rod Collins. And you do your own podcast too.
I do. And it's primarily a topical podcast. I've done so much writing that I do 20-minute podcasts on stuff that I've written over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah. And but it's also on innovation and futurism and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I take a seasons approach. So the first season I focused on digital transformation. And then the second season I focused on collective intelligence. And digital transformation, I think most people see it as a technological revolution, which I think it is. But I think it's even more so a sociological, a socioeconomic revolution, because what the digital revolution has done, it's made it practical to set up peer-to-peer organizations. And although they've been around in real life, if you will, for a while, they've not been very popular. They've just been in some niche spaces. But if you look at a thing like Google or Wikipedia, those are all network type structures. And the thing about networks is they're vehicles that can leverage collective intelligence.
And by that, you mean the company internal structure with their the team members?
That's one dimension of it. But I also think it can affect business and product models. So take Google.
Yeah.
Google's fundamental product model, I mean, what made them different, and I think they did it more so in the original search engine than it is today, is they leveraged the collective intelligence of the users to rank the pages. I think to some extent, Google has devolved a little bit, and I think it's become a little bit more of a hierarchical structure. And so they are adjusting their algorithms to, one of the differences between networks and hierarchies, leverage the intelligence of the elite few. And true networks leverage the collective intelligence of the many. I think Google started out as a true network, but I think it's kind of morphing more into a centralized hierarchy. But maybe someday it'll go back.
And what we're seeing is a bit of the clash of the generations, in that the former senior leaders who might be baby boomers or Gen X, they tend to have more of this hierarchical preference, whereas the new cohorts coming through, being millennials, Gen Y, Gen Z, they want a more flat structure, a more collaborative environment. And is that what you're seeing, Rod?
Yes, but I've been a bit disappointed. I mean, that was my observation about 10 years ago. Let's take Google, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, Google's search engine, you know, just leveraged the collective intelligence of the users that ranked the pages. I think when Sergey Brin and Larry Page were at the helm of Google, they brought in what was referred to as the hacker mentality. Information should be free. But something has happened over the last 2 to 3 years. There is new leadership at Google. I don't know if that's coincidental or not, but Google has morphed into the most centralized corporation the world has ever seen. And they have introduced a level of censorship that that we certainly have never seen before in the United States. And I have to say that I'm surprised. And so there was a book written at the beginning of the digital revolution. Eric Raymond wrote a book called The Bazaar in the Cathedral. And he said that the old way of organizing centralized, top-down hierarchies, traditional structures, well, they, you know, they built cathedrals, and that this new way of organizing is more like a bazaar. It's a little bit messier, but it's faster and it's more collegial. I think we've lost a little bit of that. I hope we don't lose more, but I'm not terribly pessimistic because I think we're in between the first wave and the second wave of the digital revolution. And I think in the second wave, we're going to get back to building true networks. We're going to get back to leveraging collective intelligence. I think there'll be a whole new generation of or a new big tech, if you will. And I think people will be careful to build it, for example, on blockchain platforms. In other words, they'll be designed so that they are distributed, that nobody can centralize it. And I'm beginning to see, if I could just go on an aside for a moment, one of the things I think we're seeing in what I would call the devolving of these once promising companies is it's the old Lord Acton quote that says, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, I think as we go forward, we need to take a look at how we exercise power. And I would modify Lord Acton's quote to say that coercive power corrupts, and coercive power corrupts absolutely. And what has happened is these large platforms have become very, very coercive, whereas once they were collegial. I think there's another dimension of power. It's not one that we have much experience with, but I think it's the opportunity we have as humanity. And I think it's a big choice we're going to have over the next decade or two. Will we build our social structures on foundations of collaborative power? And I think collaborative power is not corrupt. It's fundamentally altruistic.
Well, but the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And exactly. So what you're doing is you're taking the group mind, all the people working in an organization, if you're taking on board their suggestions, well, then you're going to have more elegant solutions to problem solving. Would that be right?
I think that's part of it, yes. And I my first experience with collaborative power happened about 20 years ago. When I was an executive with the Blue Cross Blue Shield Federal Employee Program in the United States. And it's a health insurance program that provides insurance to all the federal employees. It was about 4 million people. And it was, when the time I left it, it was a $19 billion business in terms of US dollars. In this structure, we had 39 independent corporations who were in a business alliance to deliver a seamless product. And in the mid-1990s, I was asked to lead the operations and to turn the business around. And we couldn't reach agreement or closure very, very easily. We had great difficulties getting the 39 companies to align. And so when I was asked to do that, I sat back and said, you know, for years, we've been leading this business like it's a regular business, top-down hierarchy. We give directives that we were located in Washington, D.C., which is where the home office is, if you will. And I thought, you know, we're really leading a network, not a hierarchy. So we have to learn how to lead a network. And there's nothing out there on how to do that. So we were a bit of pathfinders. But one of the things we did, it was a very important discipline, is we developed a meeting format, which is now known as the Collective Intelligence Workshop. And what we did is we got a microcosm of the business in the room in the presence of about 40 or 50 people. We did something that's normally not done. We got all different levels in the same meeting and people from all different areas. And we really focused on all dimensions of diversity, not just the usual demographics, but you know, we were looking at business diversity. We were looking at different ways of thinking, but we wanted enough people in the room. So if anybody had an objection, they would be able to speak it.
So how many people were in the room? Like I'm thinking 50 people?
40 to 50 people is what you need. Okay.
Right.
And the what we did in setting these meetings up, we set them up for 2 days and we said, we're not going to have any debate because debate wasn't working for us. I mean, literally for two decades, we couldn't reach closure on a lot of key items. So we used facilitative techniques, put people in round tables. We had disciplines like clarifying questions where if a presentation was made, you couldn't object or disagree. All you could do is ask clarifying questions. And what we wanted to get people to do is we need to start listening to each other before we go down paths of different ways of thinking. And then we had other techniques during the course of the meeting in which we could converge the thinking in ways that work. Well, it was immensely successful. Within 2 days, we were able to accomplish what we hadn't done in two decades. We had 50 people unanimously agreeing to a course of action, and we were astounded. And what we discovered was the incredible power of collective intelligence. And we never get there with our usual debates.
And also the power of the art of asking good questions.
Exactly. The focus is on the questions. In a debate, the focus is on answers. So if you and I are in a debate, what's going to happen is you sit there and you're convinced you have the right answer and you have data to back it up. And I'm convinced I have the right answer and I got data to back it up. And what we do is wind up talking past each other. I never take any time to truly listen to you because I'm already convinced you're wrong. And I listen to disagree, not to understand. That's and right. You do the same. Mm-hmm. So what happens in debates is you achieve, when they're successful, the best you usually do is what's called a compromise or a least common denominator solution. Well, one of the exercises that we would do in these collective intelligence workshops is we would process ideas in small group tables. And that was important because when the ideas were presented, you didn't know who the individual author was. Instead of the vice president's idea, it's table one's idea.
And what's an example of an idea they'd be debating, Rod?
Or we might ask them, what are the three or four most important things we have to do to improve a business process?
Fine.
Okay.
Fine. Yeah.
And something like this is good for. And so those ideas would. So you got these flip charts with about five ideas on them. Maybe they come from five different groups, six different groups. You got 25, 30 ideas on the wall. And we would have this discussion. I would say to them, point out two items that look like they're the same. And let's talk about them. And if they are the same, we're going to keep one and discard the other. But if they're not the same, we're going to refine the language so we understand the differences. So here's the difference between a normal debate and what we did here. We were talking about ideas that were similar. And the only way that you could say whether they were the same or not was you had to understand each idea. So everybody is understanding every idea that was on the flip charts. Whereas in a debate, we're talking about how is my idea better than your idea? Whereas in this facilitated session, the focus was how is this idea different from that idea? And what we wound up doing is we were enhancing everybody's understanding because you had a visit with every idea, not from the point of whether I agree or disagree, but from the point of view, do I understand it enough to know the distinction between these two ideas or not? And then at the end of that, we would wind up, you know, we condensed the list maybe down to about from 30 items to about 15 to 18. And then we would pass out stick-on dots. And we would tell people, vote them any way you want. You can put four items on one item or you can spread them out, do whatever you want to do. And out of that exercise would usually come 90% of the time, it's a top four items. And I look at the group and say, if we do these four things, will it make this business process better? And everybody would look and go, yeah, those are the right things. And when I would look at the list, I'd say, isn't that interesting? Item A was important to one political faction. Item B, which appeared to be contrary, was important to another political faction. And items 3 and 4, or C and D, if you will, they were the glue that made the whole set work. So apparently contradictory ideas could be part of a total solution of 4 ideas, which is how we accomplish unanimous agreement. So when I say to you that collective intelligence or collaborative, now that collective intelligence, I think using that, what we did in these meetings was we were accelerating what I would call collaborative power. So now you got 50 people leaving the room. They all agree on this. It's not been directed. They own it. And what was amazing is it magnified outside the room, because this was such a high level solution that when people heard it who weren't even in the meeting, their reaction would be, oh, that's very well thought out. And they get behind it. And so this is what I mean. If you can leverage collective intelligence, if you tap into collaboration power, it is inherently altruistic. And so there was no need for coercion, because you've listened to all the voices and we blended them. And so if we can learn how to do that on a large scale, then, then we'll be leveraging our collective intelligence. We will be tapping into collaborative power, and I think creating a more humane society.
A part of this great resignation is, and tell me your opinion on this, that organizations are saying, well, you have to come back to the office. You can't have hybrid working from home, you know. So is that part of it? Organizations are saying, well, as an employee, you have to follow our rules, and these are our rules now that we're coming out of COVID.
If you think about it, organizations have been like that since they really came in vogue in the late 19th, early 20th century. Frederick Taylor did not have a high opinion of human nature, and he is the father of scientific management, which began in the United States and went over the world. It's probably the most influential export the United States has ever had. And what we take for granted as management, command and control structures, goes back to Frederick Taylor. But what that is, it's a coercive power structure where the few at the top have the power, and we even call it command and control. Now, I think, and this is the topic, excuse me, this will be the topic of the book I'm working on now, which I'm calling The Intelligent Organization. I think that business management, in order to keep up with the rapid pace of change, has got to step away from traditional centralized command and control management, because it's too slow and it's not intelligent enough, because it's leveraging the individual intelligence of a few people. Somewhere around 2004, Eric Teller, who was head of Google's R&D function, I believe that's the area he's in charge of, but he made this observation that somewhere around 2004, the ability for any single human being to process what's happening in the world in real time has been exceeded. In other words, none of us, no single person can do it. So the idea we build these structures, put a CEO up top who is supposedly the smartest person, and we're going to use that person's individual intelligence to make all the key decisions, is dangerous, because the world is moving faster than he or she will be able to process it. Now, if we build distributed peer-to-peer networks and set up self-management structures, then we are more likely to keep up with the pace of change, because self-managed networks are more likely to leverage the collective intelligence of everyone. And so let me compare and contrast the two models. The traditional model, okay, as we've talked about, it leverages the intelligence of the elite few. It focuses on the right answers. That's why we have these elite few, because they are so smart. and we get to the right answer quickly. Then we put in place a plan to execute that right answer. And then finally, we put in place procedures to assure the compliance of everyone. And the essential message is do what you're told. And so authoritative compliance is the endpoint of traditional management. In the new model, it's all very different. First of all, it's going to leverage the intelligence of everyone through collective structures. And so the unit of work is not the individual, it's the team. The focus is on the right questions. That's the most important thing. When things are changing, I need to be asking the right questions. That's what we need to be focused in on.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now, strategy shifts from being about planning to being about discovery. Now that I got the right questions, I need to be involved in the discovery process. I need to learn. I need to see what emerges. I need to invest in serendipity, which is connecting unusual things. And which means I need to have everyone in the organization not focused on authoritative control, but to be focused on intelligent decision-making, because that's what teams do. And so teams in a self-managed structure don't have supervisors. The team manages itself. The team decides its decision rights. The team may decide that one person is going to make the decision because they feel that's the smartest person for a particular item. But in another instance, the team may decide a majority opinion will do. Another time they may say we must have a unanimous decision, but they're responsible for their own decision rights. And they have enough information to make these decisions. And so a lot of modern companies like Amazon and Netflix are using these processes. In Amazon, they even distinguish between what they call type one and type two decisions. Type one can sink the firm. Only the leadership team can make those. Every other team in the organization can make type two decisions. Type one decisions, if you make a mistake, you're dead. Type two decisions, if you make a mistake, it's an opportunity for learning. And if we're not making mistakes, we're not moving fast enough. And so that's another thing about this self-managed organization. They expect that there will be failures here and there. What they don't want is big failures.
So with a self-managed organization, it takes a certain intentional leadership to lead that, because you know, you've got the team, but also you do have leaders that are part of that, that ultimately would have the capacity to contribute and even veto an idea if they think it's going to sink the ship?
Yeah, if it's a type one decision, for sure. If it's a type two, they don't veto it.
Well, who decides whether it's a type one or type two? What if the team says it's a type two and the leader says, well, I think it's a type one? They have the power of veto?
The leaders get to decide what the type ones are, but they're going to be in dialogue with everybody else. So.
And you can't just be laissez-faire, leave the team alone. You do have to have a benevolent overseeing approach.
Actually, not. and here's the amazing thing. When I speak on this, I point out to people: do you know that there is a company on this planet? It's a $3 billion enterprise. It has 10,000 people. It's in 30 countries around the world. It has made a profit, and every year it's marketed its products, and it has no supervisors and never has. All work is agreed to. There are no assignments. The CEO is there for external reasons, but has no authority to give any orders to anyone. And it blows people's minds.
And I'm trying to think who it could possibly be. Do we play 20 questions?
No, I'll tell you. It is W.L. Gore and Associates, the makers of Gore-Tex.
Right.
And if you play guitar, Elixir guitar strings. And and there's another company in it's in California. It's been around, I believe, since the early 90s. It's a tomato processing company. It went from being a startup to the world's largest tomato processor. It also has no bosses. It also has migrant workers for several months a year, and everything is self-managed.
Well, and what inspired them to get on that path?
Well, we get back to the leadership, and this is critical. The reason we continue command and control, which is a 19th century organization model in a 21st century role, is that our leaders cannot give up control. And control, if you think about it, is addictive.
It's ego, isn't it?
Well, it's more than that. It is the need for control. We've been raised in a world in which we cannot imagine power being exercised without somebody being in charge.
But here's the thing, the people with the need for control in their DNA are the ones that rise to leadership, because if they're not like that, they stay as an individual contributor.
All right. So here's an important thing. Jim Collins wrote a book, Good to Great, and a lot of people have read it. And if you've read it, you remember he talks about the level five leader. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Collins didn't want to identify leadership as one of the aspects of great companies. It was his staff who convinced him he had to do it, because they pointed out it was the only characteristic that was common across all 11 of the good, great companies. And finally, Collins agreed and he said, his staff was right. And he delved into that and he came up with, he described it. Collins is very succinct and I think has very good language. He said they have humble will. They have humility, but they're very willful. These are not meek people. And he said, he also made the statement, most organizations anti-select the very leaders they need, because what they're looking for is the person who presents themselves as powerful, strong, know-it-all people. Well, the problem with that is, now this isn't Collins's language, this is my observation. I think that model tends to bring in narcissists.
And I'll tell you something, Ray Dalio talks about that, because he talks about the fast talkers that override the introvert deep thinkers. And he actually, in his book, Principles, Life and Work, invites the introverts who are deep thinkers to actually stop the fast talkers in a meeting with, I'm sorry, I might be a bit slow, but can you please explain and clarify what you're saying? So it's up to the introverts who are deep thinkers to pull these fast talkers back. You know, it's like a stallion that's running wild. It's like you've got to actually have psychological safety and conversational equality.
Exactly. So a couple of thoughts. Let's talk about this introvert, extrovert, and then get back to the other thought.
Yeah.
One of the goals we had in mind when we designed the collective intelligence workshop was to make a safe place for introverts to be heard.
Yes.
And that happened by processing things in small groups. Introverts are more comfortable in small groups. They'll talk in groups of 6, 7, 8. They don't like to talk in groups of 25.
They don't like the town hall meeting.
No. And so this gets their voices out, okay? And oftentimes they have incredibly innovative, thoughtful ideas. And so this process I described earlier, get those ideas out. Now, I explained to you before how we would come up with this elegant set of about 4 items that everybody agrees if we do this, it's going to work. Now, when we reach this stage, because this is a safe meeting, the introverts are comfortable now talking in groups of 25 to 50 people, because there's been a tone that is set that we're not debating anymore. Now, once the dynamic becomes we're building on each other's ideas rather than pitting our ideas against each other, and then the introverts, they're very comfortable with that process. They like to build, all right? What they don't like is they don't like mean-spiritedness, and they don't like
or justify your opinion or you know, defend your point of view. It's like almost it's like the talking stick enables people to say their piece and to be heard.
Yep. And what happens, to build off of what you just said, is instead of, you know, attacking an idea, the conversation after these exercises, what you hear is this phrase or not. I want to build on that idea. And then the next minute, I want to build on that idea in this way. And what happens now, when you get a discussion where people are building on each other's ideas, that is what collaborative power looks like. When we're not building on each other's ideas and when we're in a position where we're going to say, my idea is better than yours, and if you don't give up, I'm just going to shut you down. Okay, that is an example of coercive power. We as human beings are capable of higher intelligence. And so getting back to leadership, leadership's important because the leaders of self-managed peer-to-peer networks have this humble will, and they don't have this sense that they know all the answers. As a matter of fact, as I led these processes when I was inside Blue Cross Blue Shield, I had to go through a psychological shift because I had to change what my psychological payoffs were. It wasn't about my ideas being extended or amplified. As a matter of fact, when I would lead these sessions, I was the highest title in the room and the only person who couldn't express an opinion. Because I knew if I gave my opinion, everybody would say, well, he's the chief executive. Oh. So we might also just go along because we're going to do that anyway. So even when asked, I wouldn't tell them because I would say my job is to help, is to get the best of your ideas forward. And what I learned over the, I've been doing these workshops now for about 25 years. And what I've learned over that time is I would never substitute my individual intelligence for the collective intelligence of a diverse group of people. Theirs is always smarter, always.
Well, and even Buckminster Fuller talked about that. That's where he coined the term synergy, which is, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
And that's the mindset a leader has to have. And so a practical example that I think our listeners will be familiar with, Alan Mulally was this type of humble, willful leader. He goes into Ford. The board tells him he can fire anybody that he wants on the leadership team. He tells them, I don't think I'm going to need to do that. They say, well, we're losing billions of dollars a year. I mean, you know, feel free. Well, he didn't fire a single person on the leadership team. As I recall, two left on their own because they didn't like this style that he brought in. But he knew that the secret to turning the organization around is to build the leadership team into the most highly effective team in the company, and then that will leverage from there. One of the comments that I'll make when I speak on this, when I do keynote speaking, and this always gets knowing chuckles from the audience, I say the most dysfunctional team in the typical organization is the senior leadership team. They're not collaborative. They're competing with each other to be the next CEO. They withhold information. They will work where when it's to their benefit to put another person down. And they're not working for the company. They're working for their own area so it will be the best so that that positions them to lead the company. The senior leadership team needs to be a team that is continually supporting each other, learning each other, discovering what the future is, especially in a fast-changing world, and constantly synergizing their strengths, which is exactly what Mulally did. And a senior leadership team needs to be frequently meeting in what I would call high-quality time. Mulally had his team meet once a week, every Thursday. When I led Blue Cross Blue Shield FEP, we had a strategic offsite meeting, not once a year, once every 2 weeks. We went offsite once every 2 weeks. I wanted to be offsite because I wanted us to focus on strategy.
That's right. Not people knocking at the door saying, I've got a quick question.
Right. And I wanted us to be deeply thinking about our business. And I have to say that I had the privilege of working with an incredibly, incredibly talented team who really, really, they were really supportive of building this strong leadership team. And as a group, there was just a tremendous amount of humble willfulness among them. And we wound up turning the business around in a very positive way.
Well, you brought up the N word before, narcissism. How do you weed out the narcissists that don't demonstrate humble will?
That's the hard part, because if anybody's familiar with the psychological literature, it's very hard to undo narcissism. And so what we really have to be doing is looking at future generations of leadership and changing our paradigm about what it looks like. Don't look for the in-charge person. Don't look for the show person. This is another picture Jim Collins paints that I really, really like. When things go wrong, they look in the mirror. When things go right, they look out the window. With the narcissist, when things go right, they look in the mirror. And when things go wrong, they look out the window. So if one is a chairman of a board and you're selecting leaderships, or if you're a CEO looking for leaders, find some way to find out if things go wrong, is this particular person you're thinking of hiring, is that person going to look in the mirror? And if they do, hire them, or are they going to look out the window for who to blame? Because that's the most important. That is probably the key characteristic to focus in on. Hire people who will look out the window when things go wrong, because they're going to build incredible teams. They're going to build incredible morale. And they look in the mirror when things go wrong. I hope I said that right. When things go right, they look out the window. When things go wrong, they look in the mirror. And when that happens, people will really rally around them because they want to come to the aid of that leader who's taken that responsibility.
That's right. And high emotional intelligence says that went wrong. What was my behavior, or what was my contribution to it going off track? How can I do it differently next time? So it's learning from mistakes. Whereas the people that don't learn from mistakes just blame. It's outside of themselves.
It also changes the meaning of accountability. And I think accountability is terribly misused. In most organizations, accountability means who is the single person I can blame when something goes wrong. That's not what accountability is, because you can't do anything about it. Accountability is a proactive dynamic. And so what accountability is, right, if things go off the rail, who do we need to get together to build the best team to get this train back on the tracks? That's what accountability is about. It's not about looking who to blame. It's about looking who to bring together so that we can get things where they need to go. Accountability is also about being aware of leading indicators. Okay. I one of the things most organizations focus on the wrong numbers. They focus on the numbers in the financial statements. Those are important to know whether you're winning or losing. They're also important to determine pay. And I don't disagree with that. But they're not management tools. Management tools are leading indicators that will let you know if this train is going to go off the rail. So, you know, if your speed is too fast and you got a turn coming up, you want some type of, maybe you want a signal going off. That's a leading indicator. Slow it down. Okay. And so it's the leading indicators you want to focus in on, because if you are managing those, then chances are you're not going to have bad outcomes. This is, I think, another discipline that Mullally brought into Ford. When he met with his staff, they did their metrics in colors, which I think is important to do. No, numbers can kind of just be blasé. But when you walk in with something red or yellow or green, In our case, in Blue Cross Blue Shield, we added the color blue to it. Blue, of course, is going to be the highest color. But red and yellow get your attention. We need to get working on those. And you want to measure your leading indicators, but you also want to color code them. And you want to color code them. You want to color code them in a way the whole organization knows, because then you can leverage their collaborative power, their collective intelligence. If you came into our offices in Blue Cross Blue Shield, any visitor would know how we were doing, because we had our leading indicators plastered all over the walls with color codes. Mm. And if anything was going yellow or red, you didn't have to call a meeting. The staff saw it and they would get working on it and get those numbers turned around as fast as they could to get them either green or blue. That's, you use the whole power of the team.
So anybody listening to this could be a people manager, could be an individual contributor, could be a CEO or senior leader. So where does the change start, depending on where you're at? So maybe the middle manager. How can the middle manager create a movement that will encourage this collective intelligence?
I think the middle manager can bring this discipline to the group that they are with, okay? Mm-hmm. But certainly where it most needs to happen is at the senior leadership team level, because they affect the culture of the organization. What you can do as a middle manager is affect the culture of your department, but you're still going to live within the culture of the organization. And if you want to change culture, don't go off and have a 3-day offsite where we're going to bring in outside people and we're going to work on agreements and we're all going to sign pieces of paper and then go back to the office to the same system we had before, because that'll last about 2 or 3 weeks. If you want to change the culture, change the system, because if you put in a peer-to-peer network, if you put in ideas like type 1, type 2 decisions, if you set up teams, give decision rights to teams, let them know the space within that they can work and trust them to make those decisions, they will surprise you in a very, very positive way. And if you do that, you're going to have an incredibly accountable culture that is going to please your customers, because people are smart and they will step up. And that was my experience. It's this system of teams of teams, as General McChrystal called them. If you put that in place, then you're going to have a benevolent culture. If you're tapping into collaborative power, it tends to be more altruistic. It's not corruptive. And if you're tapping into collective intelligence, you're moving intelligently at the pace of change. A company that does this very well is Netflix. Look at Netflix.
Tell us about
that. They did what Blockbuster couldn't. Blockbuster couldn't transform itself. Netflix started out sending DVDs to your home. Then they moved to streaming. Then they started making movies, okay? And so they keep innovating and they're able to adjust their business and product models. And so that's what companies have to do today. You can't get stuck in one business or product model. You have to keep evolving. You have to keep adapting.
And how would we perhaps even read about what the Netflix culture, internal culture is? I mean, to be inspired to take fresh action, we need to maybe read about the role models and say, well, let's try this, let's try that. You've defined a very interesting facilitated process with a group of 50 people before. But how would we find out about these companies that are, Gore-Tex and Netflix? How do we find out what their trade secrets are in terms of how they organize their culture?
There's a book on Netflix that I think its founder wrote, Reed Hastings. You can read Humanocracy by Gary Hamel and Michelle Zanini. I've written a book on this space. It's called Wiki Management.
And you're writing the new book. When will that come out? Right.
That will probably come out in 2022. That will be called the Intelligent Organization.
Well, I can't wait to invite you back to talk about your new book when it comes out.
I look forward to the opportunity.
Well, look, it's so wonderful sharing these ideas. I think it's so inspirational. In fact, I think podcasting is the new reading because, you know, we can listen to a podcast while we're driving or commuting from place to place. Just put the earphones in. But so you've really given us some food for thought today, Rod. I really appreciate your contribution. It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.
Thank you so much. And I look forward to a future conversation again. All the best.
Thank you so much, Nina.
This episode, we've been speaking with Rod Collins on the Manage Self, Lead Others podcast for experienced and aspiring people managers. I'm your host, Nina Sunday. If you like this podcast, tell a friend. People tell me that they've listened to this program because someone told them it's a good show to listen to. And we come back every week. We interview people who share insights on how to elevate and transform team culture. Connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter. Thank you for listening. Until next time, ciao for now.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.